But before we start, I do want to read to you something that he sent out. John contracted pancreatic cancer sometime in, I think, early 2009. And he battled it valiantly for about a year and a half. And 3 months before he died, this was in January 30th of 2010, he sent this out. I think this was on his Caring Bridge. He said, "I had a," and what he says in here is pertinent to what we're going to talk about. He said, "I had a CT scan on Thursday, and we met with the doctor later that afternoon. We got a mixed report, but overall we are encouraged. The tumor on the pancreas had shrunk and is putting out fewer secretions. However, the cancer has spread to the liver with 8 or so new lesions showing up on the scan. In short, the doctor said surgery is out. Cure is not possible, but control is." He says, "I will continue on the same chemo schedule, once a week for 3 weeks, then a week off. In addition, today I began a new chemo, and I take a pill daily. The statistics show the combination of these two chemos has proven to be effective in treating pancreatic cancer that has spread to the liver. I'll have another CT scan in 2 months to see how I'm responding. The doctor said he expects my quality of life to be good. When I asked about life expectancy, he said he had learned with great humility not to try to predict things like that. However, he talked of controlling the cancer in terms of several years, not several months, but John lived about another 3 months after this. He says, Thursday morning, it occurred to me to read in Matthew, Mark, and Luke's recordings of Jesus' prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. Although their versions are slightly different, in essence, each records Jesus as praying, 'Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me, yet not my will, but your will be done.' John said, then using Jesus' very words, I prayed each version in a prayer back to God, all in with Jesus' submission to the Father's will. And so, each of my prayers ended with my submission to His will. He says, I am experiencing incredible peace, comfort, and strength, all which come from the Lord, being in that position of submission. He says, I am in His hands, and all is well. And I wanted to share that with you because he talks about God's will. And you're going to see that that's part of what we're going to look at in Romans chapter 12. So if you would turn to Romans 12, and we're going to look at two verses, really the first two verses. Romans 12, 1 and 2. Dan, I'll let you read that. Give everybody a second to get there, if you would. All right, go ahead.
Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect.
Thank you. What I want to do is to consider some of the issues, Romans 12, 1 and 2, is to consider some of the issues that Paul is raising here. In verse 1, he talks about presenting your bodies. And what does he mean by that? The word present is a Greek word, peristema, which means to put at one's disposal. To put at one's disposal. And that word body is the Greek word soma, which means your body, your personhood, your very being. And so what Paul is saying is that we're called to give and put at God's disposal our very lives. And so the question that I want to look at this morning, I really ask you, is that true of my life? Am I at God's disposal seeking to live for Him and to be in the center of His will? Or do I see God out there, He's at my disposal to give me what I want? You see, unfortunately, that's the way a lot of people see God and see Christianity. God is kind of there to give me what I want. And we need to see it in different terms, that my life is His. It's at His disposal. I'm here to be used by Him. And then he talks about this idea of being a living sacrifice. A living sacrifice. Now, over the years, I have shared, in fact, some of them, we'll see if any of y'all remember it, but I've shared a great definition of sacrifice. Anybody remember it?
You need an example?
No, the definition. It's the forfeiture or giving up of something highly valued for the sake of something of greater value. That's a great definition. And if you think through it, it has purpose to it. It's forfeiting something that is of great value to you, but you do it for something of even greater value. And when you get and understand sacrifice, it changes everything. I don't know if you remember, I'm not sure if I've ever told this, but back in my insurance days, we had these big meetings, and we'd bring in a big speaker. And I remember we were down in South Florida somewhere, I don't remember where it was, and Lou Holtz was the keynote speaker. Y'all know Lou Holtz? Dr. Lou? Everybody know who Lou Holtz is? Well, Dr. Lou was up there talking about, he was trying to apply football to business success. And he says, to really be successful, you got to sacrifice. And he goes through and tells all these great stories about great players who sacrificed. But he never really gave a definition of sacrifice. I thought, you know, he might like my definition. So when he's done, I go up to him and I talk to him and I said, I've got a great definition of sacrifice that you might be interested in. And I gave it to him, and I was, I'm sitting there waiting for him to say, that's really great. I really, could you write that down for me? Dr. Lou looked at me like, buddy, what do you know about sacrifice? He says, I'm Dr. Lou. And when we were finished, I thought, I am never, ever going to go up and tell a speaker what to do, because he didn't like it at all. But it's a great definition. He ought to use it.
He needs to
use it.
Probably wouldn't cost you a job.
Usually your speech next time, Richard.
But anyway, take that definition and think about its application to what Paul is saying in verse 1. He's saying the Christian life, really to come to Christ, you're forfeiting your life and your will for something of much greater value. And that's God's will, His plan for your life. And what do we learn in verse 2 about God's will? It is good, and is it well-pleasing, and it is perfect. The problem we have, though, guys, and let's be honest about this. Most of us don't like that word sacrifice. It seems to have negative connotations to it. Yeah, and this is not a culture, the culture that we're this is not a culture that's into sacrificing. It sounds so negative. We're nothing like the great generation. Think about all that was sacrificed back during World War II. And we don't think in terms of sacrificing today because we see it in negative terms. And what happens, this is what happens. We confuse it with the idea of deprivation. We think they're kind of the same. That I just got to deprive myself of something. I just got to give up something. There's nothing really in it for me. But we need to know there's a huge difference between deprivation and sacrifice. There's a woman by the name of Mary Hunt who wrote some great words on this. Let me read it to you, and then I'll stop and see if you have any comments. She says, budgets, diets, and New Year's resolutions must top the list of things most likely to fail in a person's life. No wonder, she says, because each of them spells deprivation, and deprivation feels terrible. We can handle it only for short periods of time before we simply cave in and give up. She says, emotions and desires can be so powerful that they overcome all good sense and render any potential change completely out of the question. But she says, but you can control your emotions. And she says, what I've learned is that I could replace my fear of deprivation with the joy of sacrifice. I've learned to harness my powerful emotions, turning them into my ally instead of my enemy. And I purposely set out to embrace sacrifice and reject all feelings of deprivation. Sacrifice means to give up something of value for the sake of something else that is more important or more worthy. Deprivation means to have a possession or enjoyment just taken away from you. She says, once I learned the startling difference between the two concepts, I understood immediately why meaningful change kept eluding me and eludes others. She says, when it gets right down to it, sacrifice is a very beautiful concept. It involves purpose. It acknowledges a goal that's more worthy and of greater value than the sacrifice itself. There's no deprivation. Simply a choice to give up something of lesser value now in order to have or achieve something far more worthy, particularly in the future. Any comments on this? Any questions? Are you with me on what I just said? I assume that's a yes. Okay. What you're going to find, guys, in the Christian life, there are often things that you, as you grow in wisdom and maturity, that you realize, you know, I need to eliminate this from my life just because it's wise and good. But I want to talk about two areas of life that I think we really struggle with. I don't know how many of you have heard this said, but if you really want to know what a person's life is really all about, what's really important to them, all you need to do is look at two things. What are those two things? Checkbook and what?
Calendar.
That's it. How you spend your time and how you spend your money. Like I told Dan, I know I'm going to meddle a little bit in your life when I start talking particularly about your money. But, you know, that's part of my job, to meddle.
Talk to John. What if you don't have any?
Have any what? Money or time? Well, then you don't. Then I won't be meddling with you. Then
I'm safe.
But anyway, think about that. There's a lot of truth in it. I mean, look at how do you spend your time, and what do you do with your money? We're going to look at both of those. You know, when it comes to time, yeah, Bill. Sorry.
This kind of goes back on the NIV. It says, "Then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is." What's the test and approve portion
I think basically, as you become a living sacrifice, as you really surrender, you will begin to discern what His will is, and you will see what you'll find over time when you're in the center of God's will. You'll find that it's good and well-pleasing and perfect.
So the test is not No.
It's kind of like you're testing it to determine and finding that it's, you know, and as you do, you find that it is true and that it's good and well-pleasing and perfect.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. All right. When it comes to time, this is where the problem is. How much time are we willing to give to God? Not only to spend time with Him, but particularly in ministering to other people. You see, it requires time to do that. We've seen this, and it is a sacrifice of time, is what Jimbo does in the prisons, the prison ministry. Now, he needs men to go in there and lead small groups, and they read and go through the book, The True Measure of a Man. And some of you may have participated, and I know he's grateful. But the problem we run into is a lot of men don't want to give up that much time, because you really have to sacrifice an evening once a week for 8 to 10 weeks. But I guarantee you, it's kind of like a guy yesterday morning who's sitting right where Dan is. He went recently. He gave up a week of his time to, as a parent, to go to a mission trip in Washington, D.C. with, any of y'all familiar with Big Time Ministries? It's over at Mount Brook Junior High. He didn't want to go, but his son was going. They needed another parent, and so he went. He said, "I went begrudgingly." But you know what? He came back and said, "It was one of the greatest weeks of my whole life. It changed me." You see, that's he sacrificed something of great value, a week of his life. But he says the value of what he got out of it, he says, I can't measure. And that's what happens. You know, I just read an interesting piece from a wise older Christian man. And you know, if we could probably have a really interesting, lively conversation if I asked the question, why is our culture so lost and messed up? What do you think are the reasons? I bet we could come up with a host of ideas, don't you think? This guy said something interesting. He says, I believe that our culture is so messed up and lost is because Christians and the church, which have had a huge influence in our history, but today Christians and the church are being so ineffective. We're no longer being salt and light in the culture. We think I can be passively good and it'll make a difference. And I think he may be right. I wouldn't put all the blame there, but I think there's some truth to that. Because when Christians and the church are salt and light, they get out and they impact the culture. And I wonder if we lost our influence. Back in 1977, I lived in Atlanta in the fall of 76 and then the spring of 77. And it was funny, I was telling my wife, I said, you know, it was the fall of 76. That's, 40 years ago? It was the Olympics were going on, and I remember the only way I could communicate with anybody was with my landline that I had in this little garage apartment. Just shows you how things have changed. And I had a black and white television. I had three stations, but I did get to watch the Olympics, and I got to watch the debates between Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford. But just shows you how things have changed. As far as, you know, the way things are communicated today. But in the spring of 77, Francis Schaeffer came to Atlanta. Now, I don't know if you don't know, some of you won't know who Francis Schaeffer is. He's been dead probably 20, 30 years. But he's one of the great Christian scholars of all time. He lived in Switzerland. He ran a ministry called Le Bris. And basically, people who were in search for God and search for spiritual truth, particularly really very bright people, would go and they'd stay there, and they would work during the day, and they'd have discussions at night, and scores of people became Christians through his ministry. But he wrote a number of books, but his most famous book is called How We Should Then Live. And what he did, it was 10 chapters of the book, it was about Western civilization, and it's a really good book. But in it, there was 10 chapters, and they had made a film of each chapter. So this was a two-day seminar, and it was at the Atlanta Civic Center, and it was packed. And he would answer, basically, you'd watch a film, and then he would take questions from the audience. And it was very powerful. And I share that because Schaeffer was kind of a prophet. And he says, I fear what I see coming. And basically, he says, what I see is two things happening in the church. And he called them two impoverished values. And you know what's interesting? Both of these impoverished values have to do with the calendar and the checkbook, with our time and our money. He says the first impoverished value, he called it personal peace. Now that doesn't sound like an impoverished value, but let me read to you what it was. He says personal peace means just to be let alone. Not to be troubled by the troubles of other people, whether across the world or across the city or across the street. To live one's life with minimal possibilities of being personally disturbed by other people. Personal peace means wanting to have my personal life pattern undisturbed in my lifetime, regardless of what the results will be in the lifetimes of my children and my grandchildren. And so again, are we willing to give our time investing, even if it's just one person? Because, guys, we are surrounded by people who are hurting either physically, financially, emotionally, spiritually. That's why I say, just begin to pray. Ask God to open a door. Provide me somebody that you want me to help. But what he's saying is, no, people, I don't want to be disturbed. I don't want to be bothered. If that's the way the church is really approaches life, we're in trouble. Now, the second impoverished value, he said, was affluence. But this is the way he described affluence. It means an overwhelming and ever-increasing prosperity, a life made up of things, things, and more things, a success judged by an ever higher level of material abundance. This is a good place to stop, see if you have a question or comment. Anybody?
Are you making the point on that first point you make about not church not going out and trying to help? Do you think that's occurred over the last 20, 30 years?
Well, let me put it this way. I think there are some churches that do a really good job at really getting out and making a difference, and I think there are probably some that that don't.
There are personal peace churches?
I think there are. I think there probably are. I mean, it's and what happens is you get into a little holy huddle, and you're all everything's focused inward and not ever focusing outward. And when if the church ever gets to that point, that's when that's when we no longer have an influence on culture.
It's Michael Phelps, story about reading the purpose-driven life. I mean, the first line of that book is, "It's not about you."
Yeah, it's not about you. Amen. Anybody else? Bob Buford, I want to spend some time. This is where I'm going to meddle in here. Buford says the one area of life that we have a hard time really sacrificing in any way is our money and our lifestyle. And he says most people spend their money, unfortunately, unwisely and frivolously, primarily to, he says, either to impress others or just to spend it on our pleasures. And we've had interesting conversations about this. I met this morning and then yesterday morning. And I think I'm going to share this because I think it can be enlightening. All right. We've spent a lot of time talking about money back when we studied Ecclesiastes and when we studied Proverbs. So we're not going to spend whole much more time on it. But this could be, I think, a value. Take your money. Your financial resources, you can divide them really into five areas, okay, or five components. Or if you can break down where your money goes into to five. The first would be what we would historically call the necessities of life. What are there are four basic necessities in our world today to operate your to live your life. That's three.
What'd you say, four?
Four.
Personal peace.
Food, shelter, clothing, and transportation. I mean, you got in our economy, you got to have transportation. Would you not agree? Now, the problem, of course, is so funny. Yesterday, somebody said, "I think you ought to put insurance in there." I said, "Why?" He says, "I spend more insurance than anything. You got a bunch of kids, a bunch of teenagers. I feel his pain." I said, "No, insurance goes under transportation and shelter, insuring your cars, insuring your home. That's part of the deal." The problem is when necessities end up becoming, what did I call it? Necessities become status symbols. When my shelter becomes a status symbol. When my transportation becomes a status symbol, that's when, if you're not careful, you can get in trouble. Trying to keep up with the Joneses. Now, the second is something that they talk about and that Jesus talks about in the Old Testament. You pay your taxes. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, the things to God of God, to the things that are of God to God. Then you've got, and a number of you, your businesses revolve around this. That we'll just call it saving. You can call it investing if you want to. And saving is very biblical. It's about the preparing for the future. And most people have to, in preparing for the future, have two things to prepare for. Education of their kids and retirement. When you can't work anymore, you can't earn a living anymore. If you have to have something set aside for that. Then the fourth is giving. And then you got the fifth. That is, you spend your money on luxuries, which are those things over and above your necessity, luxuries, and pleasure, your pleasures. And I left anything out? I mean, don't you think pretty much everything falls under one of these categories? Now, I share this because if you really want to figure out how you're doing, if you really want to figure out, and only you can do this, if you want to figure out how important your money is, figure out what percentages go to what. It'll tell you a lot about yourself. And you know what? It's if you really want to do it, it's not hard. Pull out your tax return. You can figure out all your income. You can probably get all your giving. You can get your taxes off of it. And then you do a little work and you can find out. And it really will help you figure out where everything's going and what's important to you. Now, in this book that I'm working on, there's a part. What I'm doing, I'll just tell you real quick what it's on. It's about wisdom. The search for wisdom. And I've taken what I consider 12 of the most strategic areas in a person's life, and I have four or five short essays on each one of them. And one of them is on financial wisdom. And one of the great resources that I used, and my son has read it because I suggested it to him, and it's really great. It's called The Millionaire Next Door. Did anybody ever read it? It's really, really a good book. But one of the things you find, and it doesn't really fit into the equation, I guess you could put debt up here, but the reason that so many people struggle financially is because of debt. And you know what primarily is? Debt right here. And that's number five. And the other thing, and this isn't from the book, but this is what I've learned, is that it's amazing how many people give away almost nothing. They give almost zero. In fact, I was talking to a guy who's head of a stewardship at his church, and it's a really fine church. He says, you wouldn't believe the number of people that give zero to the church. They're members of the church, and they give zero. And what I've had several people say, you wouldn't believe the number of people that live in my community, and they're usually referring to Mount Brook, and I don't mean that in any way. It could be Vestavia or Homewood, but that have an unbelievable lavish lifestyle and are broke. They have no money. They have a big income, but they have nothing. And what I've learned in all this is everybody is very secretive about what they do with their money. I mean, and it can be very deceptive. It really can. That was a great thing about the millionaire next door is some of the most wealthiest people in our country. You look at their life and you never know it. You never know it. Comments or questions? Well, the reason I share these thoughts on sacrifice and deprivation is hopefully it will be helpful to you. That the thought of, all right, I'm going to forfeit something that's of value to me, but I'm going to do it knowing that it's for something of greater value. And I would just say this, particularly when it comes to money, Jesus takes this very seriously. You know, nowhere does he ever condemn money. He warns us a lot about it, what it could do to us if we're not careful. But he says, you know, I'm looking for my people to be faithful with the resources they've been given, to be good stewards with what they have. And that's what we're called to do. And I'm gonna just leave it at that. And we're going to look at, for the next 15 minutes, looking at verse 2. Questions or comments? Okay. In verse 2, it says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. Or the NIV says good, well-pleasing, and perfect. You seem to see this a lot in the Scripture. Either or. Paul seems to be saying either you are being conformed to this world, in other words, your life is indistinguishable, it's not distinguishable from the world that we live in. We're just like everybody else in the world. or our lives are being transformed. We're conforming to the world, or we're being transformed. And in Romans 8:29, it says, what does this transformation look like? We're becoming more Christ-like. It's like you're saying one of these is taking, both of these aren't taking place in your life at the same time. One of these two things, either you're becoming more like the world, or you're becoming more like Christ. Which is it? This seems to be, you see this in Scripture a lot, either or. Ravi Zacharias believes this is a huge issue. And if you're not careful, it'll easily keep you away from the truth. Now, I don't know if you remember, we talked about back, I don't know if it was in the spring or the fall, that there are two types of logic. There's the either or. This comes from Aristotle. It's like a good way to understand either or is take a math problem. 100 times 100. And it's multiple choice. A is 1,000. B is 10,000. C is 100,000. Can there be more than one answer?
No.
No. It's either A or B or C. But then you have what's called the both and. And this comes in different, in modern, this is very modern. It's kind of like we go to the Guggenheim Museum in New York, which is a modern a museum of modern art. And you look at this beautiful painting. Or you, let me say that. You look at this painting, and you think, that's the ugliest thing I've ever seen. I can't believe they call that art. Is that my phone? And yet Dan looks at it and says, that's the most beautiful painting I've ever seen. This is the question. Is it a beautiful painting? You see, that falls out of that. You got the either or, and you got the both and. And there are certain areas of life where you have to use the either or, like mathematics. But then there, when it comes to art or the arts, you know, you can use the both and approach. You know, you might think a movie's great. Somebody else might think it's not great. Is it a great movie? Why am I, Brent? What does this have to do with Romans 12:2?
It's an either or proposition.
That's exactly right. And you know what? You see this throughout the Scripture. God gives us a lot of either ors, and we want it to be both and. We want it to be both. For instance, Galatians 1:10. Are you seeking the favor of men or of God? If you're still trying to seek the favor of men, you cannot be a bondservant of Christ. You can't do both, is what he's saying. You can't seek to live your life to win man's approval and seek to live your life to win God's approval. Let me put this another way. How well do you think you could truly love and be devoted to two different women and have two wives? It's hard enough being devoted to one. And the reason is, basically said, you can't do it. You can't be completely devoted to one woman and try to be completely devoted to another. 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 and 16 says, do not love the world. Do not be in love with the world or the things with us in the world. He says, because if you love the world, then the love of the Father is not in you. It's an either or. Probably the most significant that we're most familiar with is Matthew 6:24. Let's look at that real quick. Matthew 6:24.
It'd be interesting to have a test on whether you're conforming to the world or not. I mean, you could make a list of the things that
you could.
Sort of
you want to try to pull that one off for us?
No, that's why you're.
All right, Matthew 6:24. Everybody there? Ben Patrick, how about reading that?
No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money.
You can't serve both God. You know, he's saying you can't. But you know what our problem is? What's our problem? We think we can. We try to. We think I can serve them both. That's why it's a, that's why it's this either or. What does Jesus say in Luke 11:23? He says, either you are with me or what?
Against me.
Yeah. There's no middle ground. Now we might look for middle ground. Isn't there some way I can be in the middle? You know, I want to serve God a little bit here, but you know, I really don't want to over here. I mean, I don't want to be. I want balance in my Christian life. You know, I think people think that way. I don't want to take it way. You know, I've been accused. You take this Christianity way too serious. I'm saying, now, how do you do that? If you're to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, how do you take it to? How can you be too serious about it? Either or. There's a part. The Bible is saying, you know what it's really saying? You can't live with a divided heart. You really can't. Revelation chapter 3, verses 15 and 16. Very significant as it relates to this. Turn to Revelation 3 real quick. And we're going to read verses 15 and 16. Revelation 3, 15 and 16. All right, everybody there? Mike Caputo, you going to read that for us?
Yeah. I know your deeds, that you are neither cold nor hot. I wish you were either one or the other. So because you're lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I'm about to spit you out of my mouth.
What's that all about?
Scary.
What's he saying?
There's no middle ground.
Yeah, he says, you know what he's saying? Yeah, he's saying, I would rather you be hot, really on fire for God, or cold. I mean, you know, just kind of go ahead and reject me. But I can't stand it when you're lukewarm. I'll spit you out of my mouth. The bottom line with all of this is Scripture is saying, I think, that we believe that we can live with a divided heart. I can be lukewarm. I can straddle the fence. I can love God and love money. I can be devoted to both. And he's saying, no, you really can't. Your heart has one affection that's greater than all others. What's that going to be? You can't divide the heart when it comes to, you know, your supreme loyalty. I remember Drayton Neighbors sharing, you know, Drayton was, you know, he quite the scholar. He was agnostic. And yet God began to kind of pull at him. And he's got a great testimony. Never heard it. And he said, I finally decided I was going to read the Bible from cover to cover. I felt like that's my best thing for me to do. And he said he read it, and as soon as he finished the book of Revelation, he put the book down and he said, I felt like God was saying, either you're with Jesus or you're against Jesus. There is no middle ground. And he said, for him, what really got to him was basically the thought of rejecting him and being against him. He says, that was not an alternative. That just was not an alternative for me. And that's when he became a Christian. Now, I think most of you remember this. It's in the book, True Measure of a Man. But I think it's very powerful, and it really kind of it really illustrates what we've been talking about. And that is that what Bob Buford shared, the thing that changed his life. I don't know if you remember it. You know, Buford had built this media empire out in Texas. Very, very wealthy guy. But he also felt called to start this ministry called Halftime Ministries, and which was instrumental in me leaving what I did to start this. And he couldn't figure out how he was going to do it. And he even called, so he called in this famous business consultant. The guy wasn't a Christian. He said, I wanted a clear thinker. And he brought him in, and they met for a day. And he told him everything that was on his mind. Told him all about his business, told him all about it. And finally, this guy's name was Michael It's spelled K-A-M-I, Kami, Kami. Said, Bob, before we can proceed, before I help you come up with a strategic plan for the rest of your life, we've got to determine one thing. What's that one thing? Anybody remember?
What's in the box?
What's in the box? Remember that?
Yep.
He drew a box. Of course, Bob says, what's the box? What are you talking about? What is that? He says, the box, everybody has a box. And he says, in that box is your primary number one loyalty in all of life. And he said, listening to you describe your life, it boils down to two things, one of two things. It's either your business, which he put down a dollar sign, or your religious faith and what you want to attempt to do to help people. And he put a cross. He says, you got to figure out what's first. Doesn't mean that you got to get rid of one, but what's going to be first? And Buford said, nobody ever asked me that before. He said he had to kind of scratch his head for a minute, and he said, well, you know, if you're going to put it that way, it's got to be the cross. And he wrote the cross in there. And he said that changed everything for him. He said he didn't sell his business, but it said it helped me figure out how to, I guess in one sense, arrange my calendar. You know, how I was going to spend my time between this new venture I was going to start and then the business that I had. And so I think this is significant to realize that every one of us at this table, we all have a box. There's a box. And something's in that box. Something has my highest loyalty. And that's the question we need to ask. What is that going to be? Now, I realize this was brought up this morning. I would hope every one of us wants Christ in that box. But that doesn't mean sometimes he doesn't slip out of the box and something replaces him. Now that's going to be a battle as you live this life. But what you want to see is that the trend of your life, that your desire is that he be in the box. Because as C.S. Lewis says, once you get that right, it impacts the whole rest of your life. It's kind of like we use the illustration of the wheel. He's supposed to be the hub, and then you got all the spokes that go out from the hub. And that those spokes are just the different areas of our lives. If you get the center right, if you get what's in the box right, it impacts everything else that we do. In one sense, it pulls it all together and gives our lives coherence and meaning. And as someone says, it makes sense out of life. That's the way you make sense out of life.